dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Who better to provide us some intelligence about the war for the free world than a distinguished veteran of many aspects of it, both in the uniform of the United States Army, through whose ranks he rose to the exalted status of colonel, and as a civilian in the United States Defense Department, in which he served as the Director of Cybersecurity Policy, Strategy, and International Affairs in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. His name is Colonel John Mills, again, United States Army retired. He is, among other things, a contributor to the Epoch Times and a very, very important member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. John Mills, it's good to have you back, sir. Welcome.
Frank, it's a pleasure as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, listen, I wanted to talk to you first and foremost about an article that appeared on the 2nd of July in Epoch Times, a terrific outlet. I'm so proud of you for your frequent contributions there, John. It's about why do retired and now active duty generals and admirals behave the way they do? First of all, remind us, for those who are not paying as rapt attention as they should, what kind of behavior you're talking about, John, and then we'll get into the whys.
Well, Frank, this is, after such a long career, this pains me what I'm seeing it happen in front of us. We really saw it. This goes back to really the 2004 election, I would say the BCAD, of essentially politicalization, hyper-politicalization of the general and officer and flag officer, admiral ranks. On the retired side, but now with General Milley's testimony just a few days ago, now we have active duty generals that I would say have crossed the Rubicon, crossed a almost an unreturnable checkpoint, and have essentially become partisan combatants.
John, of a man who has served in uniform with great distinction, let me say, you know the promotion business, especially as you get to the ranks of colonel and then flag officers. It's an increasingly political process, is it not? You have to be something of a politician as a military man to become a flag or a general officer, a admiral or general, do you not? And what's different about what's been going on of late? And when did it really start, as you see it, to become such a politicized process in the sense that it is really problematic?
Well, we've always had this phenomenon of peacetime and wartime generals. Wartime generals are our heroes. They are patriots and do great things for the country. On the other hand, most of what we see are peacetime generals. Grant from the Civil War was a wartime general. He was very disliked by his peer group. Fast forward to today, even Patton during World War II, but fast forward to today, we have the peacetime phenomenon dominates, and it establishes a narrative and a status quo. It's all not about performance, it's about conformance to a narrative and a viewpoint.
And that would be a viewpoint on the left, which is rather starkly at odds with the traditional character, not to say that it's been political typically, but the conservative values that are not only traditional in the military, but that are really enshrined in the U.S. Code of Military Justice and so many other aspects of the culture of the military, no?
Yeah, absolutely. Milley crossed the line, I would suggest. I'm very concerned. He rightfully, in many ways, kept the military out of the election process, which by law, the election process is a civil process. The military has no role, as opposed to what many, even potentially, I would say, on our own side, shout about. Where he crossed it was his comments about, I want to understand white rage, words to that effect. He essentially was parroting Black Lives Matter and Antifa, which struck a chord that he was essentially taking sides. He's using the language of the groups that want to destroy this country. What's going on, and Milley has not raised a finger, as far as I'm aware of publicly, about this gentleman, Mr. Bishop Garrison, a decorated veteran himself. I will compliment him for that. But he is leading the review of DOD instruction 1325.06. And everybody's like, what in the world is that? Well, that's the key guidance on political activism by uniformed and civilian personnel. Bishop Garrison has the pen on writing that. And in his worldview, everybody who opposes or has a different policy viewpoint from the current president is a white racist, even funny enough, if you're not white. So this is just stunning. And, you know, I point to a War on the Rocks article by, I'm not going to name the name, I'd say go to War on the Rocks, an active duty colonel who just ferociously ripped into white rage, essentially, inside the military. But if you look at any modicum of study of her Twitter, she is an extremist on the other side. So we have a problem. Milley is responsible for this.
Well, he's obviously, I think it's fair to say, responding to direction from the political authorities. Both Lloyd Austin in the Secretary of Defense's seat at the moment, and from the Biden White House. I think this is now essentially marching orders that have been given to him. He may be throwing himself into it with more enthusiasm than is becoming, but maybe really a prime example of what you're talking about in terms of the politicization and even, I would argue, weaponization of the military for the purposes of the sort of critical race theory and race warfare, cultural warfare at the minimum, that is now part and parcel of the Biden-Harris administration's agenda, I'm afraid. And John, I guess what I'm asking is, in contrast to what has been happening through this past decade or so, I think particularly the Clinton years, particularly the Obama years, particularly now the Biden years, has been, the inexorable elevation of people who are willing, yes, to be political, but being political to a degree that really betrays those traditional values and culture of the U.S. military. I'm heartened by the fact that there has been a team of former generals and flag officers who have stood up under the banner of something called Flag Officers for America. That is in stark contrast to what we've been seeing. In fact, from both retired in some quarters and active duty military leaders. These folks did an open statement, as you know, and people can find it at flagofficers4america.org. And John, I just wonder, these folks seem to be speaking to and representing much more faithfully the best traditions of the United States military, and in particular, the imperative they all feel, and I know you do, having sworn an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to do just that now, even in their retirement years. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, the group you're talking about, I think, is establishing a heroic and noble and correct stand against this hyper-politicalization and weaponization of our military and standing in the breach against this. This is as Rome reached its peak and its apogee and began to collapse, this is what happened. The famed Roman military became more focused on the circus of Rome than on defending the nation state. Our military needs to focus on this. This group, I think Scott Perry, for example, was part of it. Incredible.
Major General Joe Arbuckle is one of its leaders. General Jerry Boykin, 3-star lieutenant general. And many others. Yeah, now 200 or so, I think.
Yeah, this is a strong group, and they're just historic stand and planting of a flag is important because they're the many others have become automatons. Now, in the military, we follow the lawful orders of those appointed above us. Absolutely. That's the way it's supposed to be. That's the way it has to be for
civilian
good order
control
of the military to be vector. And also civilian control, very important. Milley has, again, I'm trying to give him in some ways the benefit of the doubt, but he's established a narrative that must be followed. And again, like with Gilday, the admiral in charge of the Navy, it's the basic question is the CNO, is it his job to build deterrence capacity, build the Navy, expand our Navy to deter China, or to become woke and make sure we have everybody read certain books and become sensitive? That is a recipe for disaster.
It is. And specifically, I guess, John, with respect to the good order and discipline, the cohesion of the units in the military, the sense of fraternity that is needed to really perform effectively in combat, as you know so well.
Yeah. Their job is to prepare, deter, and if necessary, win conflict of different types, high end to low end intensity conflicts. It's to build capacity. It is not to virtue signal. If we're in the job of virtue signaling, we've lost.
Well, we're not in the job of deterring and winning wars, that's for sure. And John, I just have to say, and you know this so well from personal experience, having been in the military through thick and thin, the impact of all of this, not only on retention of people that you want to serve, patriots that you want in the military, but also the recruitment of individuals into it is at risk as well, is it not?
Yes. I mean, this deters many from wanting to join. This is a decision factor in those in, and do I want to stay in? Do I want to depart active duty and stay aligned with the Guard or Reserve? This is driving out and indoctrinating a new class and culture and a group of automatons that defending America, preparing, deterring, and if necessary, winning is no longer their focus. That is just very bad.
A disaster. No question about it. John, thank you for your insights in all of this. Look, I want to switch gears if I can quickly, because you have in your post-military and post-civilian government careers strapped on another challenge, which is election integrity. And I wanted to just talk quickly. We'll have you back on to do it at greater length on another occasion soon, I hope. But give us a sense of what you're doing with the National Election Integrity Association, and particularly in your native state of Virginia.
Oh, yes, Frank, thank you. With the NEIA, National Election Integrity Association, we are establishing a model. We're calling it FOIA, File, Sue, and Settle. A model and an action plan for the citizen to reassert themselves and retake control of their county election process, their county election board, their county school board. It is a repeatable, actionable process. We're doing a film on it. We should have it wrapped up by the end of July and begin a distribution of it. And we have some very strong support from extremely noteworthy national figures. But this is a repeatable model for the citizen, because the demand signal is just overwhelming. Daily, I'm getting calls and emails. How do I do this? What's my next step? What should I be doing? We want to organize, train, and equip the citizen. And we're working in Virginia with an exploratory committee led by Amanda Chase, state senator, on a forensic audit of Virginia. In fact, we're meeting today to discuss what is the best county to address first.
Great. Well, as this program airs, this will be in the rearview mirror, but we'll look forward to a report on how it's going on that and other fronts that you're teaching about. And when will your film, Billy, be available, and how would people get access to it, John?
Yeah, I would. We hope to have it done by the end of July, maybe sooner. What I would ask is everybody go to the National Election Integrity Association website, NEIA. If you go into Google, put in NEIA election, it should be the first hit.
Okay, good. Well, let's hope it'll stay that way, John. Hey, very quickly, I've got Dan Gallington coming up, another distinguished retired colonel, about ransomware. But based on particularly your experience in the Office of the Secretary of Defense on cybersecurity, I want to just get quickly your thoughts on what's going on in that space, John.
Yeah. Ransomware is one of the first things is we need a clear policy inside the government on that, which is usually what they hit us in our seam lines where policy is unclear. Why has ransomware been effective? Because people have been paying the ransom. It's like why are ships being hijacked off Somalia? Yeah, why are ships being hijacked off Somalia? Because people have been paying the requests, which incurs more hijackings. That's first and foremost, stop paying the ransom.
John, we'll be back to discuss that topic with you too at greater length soon, because you've got a lot of expertise in this area, as in so many, and we value so much your inputs and insights. Thanks for your cumulative service to our country, John, not least that you're rendering these days at the National Election Integrity Association, and of course, with our committee on the present danger of China. Look forward to having you back soon. In the meantime, stay well and keep up the great work, my friend. Next up, as promised, retired Colonel Dan Gallington will give us a detailed brief on what's going on in this ransomware space and the upcoming meeting with the Russians next week. What's going to come of all of that and more? Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Congress increasingly recognizes that the Chinese Communist Party poses a mortal peril to our country and the rest of the world, which it seeks to dominate. Both houses have just approved bipartisan bills to counter the CCP's advantages in key technologies with ominous military applications. Thus, legislators should also weigh in on the Chinese Communist's success on an even more worrying front, namely their deep compromise of top policymakers in the Biden administration, from the president on down. Reportedly, a key addition to their ranks is Thomas Zimmerman, a special assistant to the president for presidential personnel. He's been a fellow at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences, which the FBI warns has close ties to China's spy agency. Such appointments are a clear counterintelligence threat to America's national security. To learn more about the magnitude of this danger, visit accountabilityinitiative.org. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by another distinguished colonel, in this case, a retiree from the United States Air Force, by the name of Daniel Gallington. Dan Gallington has been a friend and colleague of mine for, well, I think 30-odd years now, and longer probably, and I'm very pleased to say that he is still in the fight, having long ago left the military, but having continued to serve his country with distinction in a variety of civilian capacities in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, at the Department of Justice, and not least as the bipartisan general counsel, the last one of those, I think, in the United States Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. He's an extraordinary and very highly regarded contributor to the public policy debate, notably in places like the Washington Times. And we're always delighted to have him with us. Dan Gallington, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a pleasure. And geez, has it been that long? I can't imagine it sometimes.
I think I've lost track, obviously, but it's been as long as I can remember, which is getting to be a shorter and shorter time all the
month. Yeah.
Anyway, Dan,
it's always a pleasure. So
much to talk about. Let's start with ransomware. This is obviously a cottage industry that is growing by the day, it seems. And as our previous guest, John Mills, pointed out, partly that's because we are incentivizing people to use these so-called ransomware techniques. Tell us what those techniques are, Dan, and why they're so damned effective, why they're so unfortunately effective, and what might we be able to do besides stopping paying the ransoms that are demanded and incentivizing more of this kind of behavior?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The latest one, the whoever it was, quote unquote, and I'm sure it was the same Russian mafia, but whoever it was penetrated a software company in Miami and as a result got access to literally hundreds of businesses across the country.
This is Kaseya?
Yes. And and before, of course, it was the, you know, the pipeline and then the meat distributor and all that sort of thing. As you know, Frank, I wrote a piece, believe it or not, 10 years ago that was published in Government Executive called, quote, The Challenge. And I suggested a way to deal with this, which involved what I called stress testing of our critical infrastructures, cyber infrastructures in this country. The thing that most people don't realize, even though we know it, is that in America, the vast majority of our critical infrastructures are in the private sector. This as compared to the rest of the world, where most of the critical infrastructures are in the public or the governmental structure. So this makes us unique as both an economy and a target. What I suggested 10 years ago was that we enable operational test teams assembled from the NSA, Cyber Command, Homeland Security, FBI, whoever you want to put on it, to do testing, stress testing of our most critical infrastructures. Now, should the Congress be involved in this? I would hope that they would authorize this sort of proactive program in a statutory regime, but the president could, using his executive authority, put such a thing in place overnight if he wanted to.
Dan, you know what's stunning to me is this is, it seems, just common sense. It's hard to believe that isn't being done right now. You wrote this article a decade ago. Where has this fallen through the cracks, and how, given the stakes here?
I think the reason for it is the reluctance to deal with the private sector component here. Nevertheless, if you look at what we did in the 90s when Ma Bell broke up and all these small cellular companies rose up, we ended up having to pass something called CALEA, which was the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act. We had to give these new companies all kinds of guidance and money to be able to respond to official law enforcement and governmental warrants they might get for communications, and they didn't know what to do. We ended up giving them millions of dollars so they could build the capabilities necessary to comply with warrants. And we ended up also authorizing something called trusted third-party providers, trusted agents, to enforce those things. So I think it's the private sector, we're reluctant to deal with the private sector and would be telling them what to do. This despite all kinds of ways that we do that already. The Attorney General could...
Dan, I've been watching closely and enormously frustrated by a similar kind of problem on the hardening of our electric grid side of that infrastructure question. And of course, it's highly susceptible to interference from cyber attackers, but it's also susceptible to sabotage. It's also susceptible, as you know so well, to electromagnetic pulse, EMP, naturally occurring or man-induced. And the private sector, again, owns most of the grid, and the private sector has been very reluctant to do anything about this problem. They tend to think it's somebody else's duty. And as you say, I think the government has been very reluctant to make them do these sorts of things. But stress testing would seem to be something well short of compelling people to take corrective action. Hopefully it would lead to that, but at the very least, it would establish vulnerabilities. And, you know, Dan, I'm sure you're very familiar with this turn of phrase. I've been told that there by government people, as a matter of fact, that there are two kinds of companies in America, those that have been attacked by cyber and those that don't know that they've been attacked by cyber. So essentially, we've all got that problem, and stress testing to ascertain specific vulnerabilities would just seem to be a no-brainer. So why isn't this being done?
It does seem to be a no-brainer. And of course, I'll remind you and anybody else who's ever had a security clearance that the Chinese have your SF-86, which is the form you filled out to get a security clearance. So they know all about your personal history and financial history because they penetrated OPM.
Right, the Office of Personnel Management.
And they got 22 million of these things. So here we go. That's a government agency that they penetrated. No, I think it's absolutely shameful that we haven't set up a way to put these critical infrastructures, first of all, define what they are, and then secondly, come up with a way that's non-aggressive and actually tell them what we're going to be doing and say, hey, we're going to come in and see what weaknesses you have and what you need to fix, and then we're going to tell you. I don't know why we can't do that.
Well, it seems as though whatever the reason has been to this point, we can't afford it anymore. And I think between discouraging people from actually paying and thereby incentivizing these ransomware hackers, whether they're in Russia or elsewhere, and establishing the vulnerabilities that are going to be exploited, if not already, certainly in the future, is the bare minimum that can be done at this point.
DOJ has created a, quote, task force to study this. And I, of course, volunteered to participate and help them in whatever way I could, non-political way. And I have not heard
hope that they will take you up on it, Dan. You've got a lot to contribute to this, needless to say, as well as the prescience that it needs to be done. Hey, Dan, while we've got you, you've spent a lot of time, we worked together on some of it, in your uniformed phase, as well as I think afterwards, in bilateral negotiations of various kinds with the then Soviet Union, now Russia. There's a meeting coming up, apparently, in which the White House says they're going to be talking to senior Russian officials about this ransomware business, which they're suspected of at least being knowledgeable about, if not actually enabling, coming from, you know, somewhere in Russian territory. Your expectations of those conversations?
Well, I think it's kind of silly, actually, because to conclude that the Putin ex-KGB officer, as he is, and the Russian government doesn't know anything about the cyber activities going on in their own country to penetrate essential targets in other countries, it's crazy. Of course they know about it. And of course they know about it, and of course there is an ongoing communication with this sort of thing. And there's a sharing of information, you know, in order to tolerate that. Putin is exacting and extracting information, national security-based information that they get. So there's a two-way conversation for sure. And, the odd part about this is when Biden sat down with Putin and talked about this before, Biden gave Putin a list of our critical infrastructure. He said, oh, don't attack these.
Right. Don't attack these.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't attack these, which implicitly says anything else.
Yeah. It's fair game. Right. And further incentivizes probably efforts in the identified areas as well, especially since there's this seeming plausible deniability that's being accorded to the Russians for what they obviously know years. Listen, Dan, one last thing before I let you go. I wanted to get your thoughts. We talked a little bit about China and the magnitude of the problem that we're facing from that quarter. Again, you've spent a lot of time in the national security arena, both as an Air Force officer and as a civilian. You've overseen the intelligence community in your capacity as general counsel for the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. So I just wanted to ask you, Dan, I am deeply alarmed at the counterintelligence threat that our country is facing today from people in the Biden administration and, well, frankly, for that matter, in the Congress, too, who have been deeply compromised by the Chinese Communist Party, starting with the president himself. But now we've just learned of a fellow who's been appointed to do presidential personnel appointments in the White House as a special assistant to the president, who has been a fellow of an institute in Shanghai, China, that is associated by the FBI with the Ministry of State Security, the Chinese intelligence service. What the heck is going on here, Dan? And what are the implications of it not being addressed and corrected immediately?
Well, I think there's probably two things that are at work, both of which are motivating the trend to be in an unfortunate way. One of them is, as a country, we've never really given counterintelligence the emphasis that it should have had and needed for many, many years. And this is a historical part of the issue. Currently, we have essentially are trying to deal with the obvious fact that the Chinese, by virtue of their worldwide financial apparatus, have gotten people indebted to them by virtue of engaging them in various activities for money, funding various programs at colleges and universities throughout here, funding programs that allow them access, but more important than that, and as you've just described, funding activities that give them access to people and to inside information and that sort of thing. They've worked the penetration of our government at the highest levels, and Congress is our highest levels. There's very little that goes on in this country that they don't know about. And I'm with you. I think it's shocking. I think we need to do a complete reversal of our historical trend against counterintelligence, and also focus on the Chinese penetration of our critical infrastructure.
Dan, the House Intelligence Committee Republicans have recently unveiled an investigation they have underway, apparently, you know, not with the support or involvement of their Democratic counterparts, which is another shocking fact. But they're looking at the penetration of corporate America and what the implications of that have been. It seems as though they had best add to the list the penetration of our government as well. Just, you know, again, as a man who has been involved in national security policymaking, just quickly, what could possibly go wrong if we have presidential personnel being made by somebody tied to the Chinese Communist Party, or for that matter, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency compromised by Chinese influence operations, let alone the president of the United States, you know, having, it seems, taken very substantial amounts of money from China. I mean, what are the implications of those compromises in terms of national security, as you see it, potentially at least?
Let's put it this way. I can't imagine anything worse right now. As far as the implications of something like that. Basically, what you're saying to when you describe that situation, assuming it's accurate, is that we really don't have any way to keep the Chinese out of our most sacred internal businesses. We really don't, because they own us. That's the implication of this. And if the rules that are in place now would have been followed, this wouldn't have happened. You just wouldn't have allowed this. except at the highest levels. Look at Biden and look at Biden's kids selling his artwork for $500,000. Who's paying him that?
One can only guess. Dan Gallington, we have to leave it at that. We'll let the question hang, but I think we all have some suspicions, don't we? Thank you for all that you do, Dan. It's great to have a chance to talk with you, and let's do it again very soon if we can. Dan Gallington.
Yes, sir.
God bless you.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
Next up, we'll speak with Rosemary Gibson. We'll get into a whole nother piece of the China problem, namely our continuing dependency on them as sources of supply for, well, medicine, among other things. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. And I have to tell you, we have in the house virtually one of my all-time favorite people. Her name is Rosemary Gibson. She is brilliant. She is incredibly knowledgeable and impressively articulate about one of the most critical issues of our time. We're talking about China. China is one of the most critical issues of our time, full stop. But specifically, she has made the country aware of a problem that had been altogether too long neglected when it comes to China, namely the fact that we have become extremely dependent upon the Chinese for a whole host of critical products, including, believe it or not, our medicines, many of them, and components that are used to make most of them, and generic drugs most especially. Rosemary Gibson is the co-author of a terrific book called China RX, Exposing the Risks of America's Dependence on China for Medicine. She is also the chair of the Healthcare Committee of a terrific group, the Coalition for a Prosperous America. She has been a great resource to us, and it's been far too long since she's been on this program, and we're delighted to have her back. Rosemary Gibson, thank you for joining us once again, and thanks for all you do. It's great to have a chance to talk about it.
Frank, it's great to talk with you today. Thank you.
All right, so let's level set, because it has been a while, and our audience may not be as conversant as I'd like with some of the most important of your findings in China RX. So just cover the fundamentals here of what it means to be dependent on a foreign country. We all should have some sense of that after the COVID fiasco, but specifically dependent on China, and specifically for medications, for heaven's sakes.
Well, Frank, right before the shutdown in March of 2020, it was literally days before the Capitol shut down and Congress went home, Senator Rubio's Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship held a hearing on COVID. And at that hearing, I had the chance to testify about what we were facing as hospitalizations were surging here in the United States and around the world. And it was the first time Congress heard this. We have, and the world, have depended on China for 90%. Think of sole sourcing of the basic components to make medicines that were used to treat people hospitalized with a virus. This is just like rare earths, which we hear a lot about, where China has a monopoly position globally on rare earths. The same exact playbook has been used by China to gain a chokehold on thousands and thousands of basic medicines that are used every day, including antibiotics, in the best of times and during a pandemic.
Let me ask you about that playbook, because this is not an accident. They've very deliberately and very aggressively worked to create this kind of dependency, have they not? And if so, how did they get away with it? Not once or twice, but now it seems on a whole host of industrial sectors that we have to have for our safety, public safety, our health, and our security.
Well, Frank, it's the same playbook in other sectors, as you say, and they attract U.S. Corporations that look to buy cheap. And it's not necessarily because China's cheaper, but because of their illegal subsidies, illegal trade practices, cartels, currency manipulation. And corporations cannot resist cheap. That's how we got here, and that same playbook is playing out here with terrible consequences. And the same month that we had this testimony on Capitol Hill, China threatened through its official news outlet, the Chinese Communist Party news outlet, to withhold antibiotics from the United States, hoping that its population will drown in a sea of coronavirus. So we've had these points of wake-up call.
Which, by the way, they unleashed upon us.
Right? So we've had this wake-up call right in front of us. And since then, hardly any money has been spent by Congress in the trillions and trillions of spending that's been authorized to have some domestic manufacturing capability so we are self-sufficient, so we can survive as a country.
This is unbelievable. But before we get to that, let me just ask you, Rosemary Gibson, I think most of our audience would say, how on earth could the government let these companies get away with it? I mean, I think we can all understand that the bottom line driven private sector would probably be susceptible to seduction by the low bidder. That's always the case. But it does seem, especially with respect to something as fundamental to, as I say, public health and safety as medicine, that somebody in government would have thrown a flag on this, and they didn't.
There was no flag flown on this, and we have these biodefense commissions and establishments, and they allowed this to happen. We can't make antibiotics here in the United States anymore. And why did it happen, Frank? Here's why I think it happened. I'll tell you your listeners a quick story. It was a major multinational pharmaceutical company that everybody would know. And someone in that company who's since left said he watched as this company got rid of its generic drug manufacturing, including antibiotics, and they sent all the specifications to China in return for and helping China build its domestic generic manufacturing. So this American-based company could have access to the Chinese market with its 1.3 billion people that are looking forward to innovative products, squeezing everything they can out of American corporations.
And that market has often proven to be elusive, shall we say, if not a phantom altogether. Is that not correct, Rosemary? Just to add insult to the injury of having ripped off our proprietary information, in some cases literally, in some cases simply buying it from willing sellers. But is it not the case that the prospect of, a billion three mouths that will consume your medications does not generally work out, at least for very long, for American corporations?
That's exactly where it's headed. The American Chamber of Commerce in China said the notion of win-win means China wins twice. So
I'm laughing, but just to keep from crying. No, that's so true. That's so
truly true. Truly woke companies know this.
Yeah.
And they see what's happening with Taiwan, Hong Kong. And so on a positive note, we are seeing some companies that are setting up manufacturing facilities here in the United States. However, there's a huge chorus. When the Trump administration came out with an executive order last August 2020, simply saying the most important medicines we need, we're going to have domestic manufacturing and the DOD and the VA and the stockpile, they should prioritize domestic companies. You wouldn't believe the outcry from Big Pharma. And you know what the argument was? Well, they'll cost more. And this is from a sector that's never had any concern about the cost of its products. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah. In fact, they have been accused for years of gouging, particularly American consumers, with their high prices. Rosemary, so there's clearly a public as well as a national security concern about what's happened here. The government has allowed it to happen. The private sector has been complicit in making it not just a problem, but a perilous one. What can be done about it now? And is the current administration, you mentioned the Trump administration had an executive order. What became of that? And was it one of the ones that was rescinded by Joe Biden on day one or shortly thereafter when he came to office?
Frank, the executive order from last August from the Trump administration was to direct the DOD, the VA, and the Strategic National Stockpile to prioritize buying domestically produced basic generic drugs, the most essential ones, not everything. And for the first several months, the Biden administration supported it. But just in April, we learned the the role that the World Trade Organization, WTO, has in these matters. And countries protested this fact because the U.S. is a signatory to what's called the Government Procurement Agreement, or GPA. Under that GPA, any country that signed it, including then Hong Kong, now China, can be just like the U.S. and bid and get government contracts. And so the Biden administration pulled that notice that the Trump administration sent back in November to WTO that it was doing this just for essential drugs a country needs to survive on national security grounds. And there is a national security exemption when it comes to this GPA or government procurement agreement.
There is in the WTO, and the Biden administration simply chose not to exercise it out of presumably deference to what, China and perhaps other countries?
I think special interests, the powerful lobby that likes cheap. And I think, I went back and looked at Bill Barr's speech on China and the role of U.S. corporations and businessmen who are effectively lobbyists for China and carrying their message here in Washington. You know, what was really interesting, Frank, was the generic drug industry came out in the middle of the pandemic saying, oh, no, we can't have domestic manufacturing here in the U.S. because that would destabilize supply chains. The same week, the Chinese premier said at the G20 meeting, we have to keep supply chains.
Rosemary, again, this is simply infuriating, I think, to anybody with a lick of sense. We clearly cannot be in a position where the Chinese could at will do, as you've indicated, what they did in this coronavirus deal. This is not a hypothetical situation. They simply refused to make certain products available, PPEs, personal protective equipment, and I think some medications as well, if I'm not mistaken. But my point is this. You're raising this alarm. It is indisputable that there's a problem. The Biden team, which I believe to be deeply compromised by the Chinese Communist Party and clearly under the influence of these large corporations, is apparently balking at even this very limited but sensible and urgently needed corrective of the Trump executive order. What's the way ahead? What do we do about this to prevent us from being perilously dependent on China? And ultimately, they will exploit that against us. I think there's no doubt about it.
Well, the Biden White House came out with a 100-day supply chain review that covered critical minerals, batteries, pharmaceuticals, and other products, Frank. That was released in early June. And it went through the issues in this particular sector that we're talking about today. But we need action. And action, there's another, longer report that's going to come out, and we don't have time to wait. China already has 10% of our generic drug market share, if not higher. And what I'm very concerned about is the poor quality. Quick story, a very prominent cardiologist said one of his patients was taking a blood pressure medicine, and the patient's blood pressure spiked to 190, which is death zone territory. They went back to the pharmacist, and the product was made in China. They switched to a different product and the blood pressure returned to normal. The drug is being tested. We are seeing over and over again substandard products coming into this country, and the FDA has not been fulfilling its regulatory obligations to inspect every manufacturing plant. It couldn't during COVID. And because China and other countries make it hard for the FDA to want to go there, remember the anal swabs for U.S. diplomats, what FDA employee wants to go to China to make sure a manufacturing plant's doing what it's supposed to? They're now talking about inspections by Zoom, remote inspections of our manufacturing facilities.
What could possibly go wrong with that? A Chinese platform, no less.
No less. I say Zoom just for,
effect.
Hyperbole, but that's where we're headed. And that's like saying, we have a plane crash and let's bring in the NTSB by video conference.
In a controlled country, which doesn't want us to get to the bottom of anything, as we've seen with Wuhan, no less. So, Rosemary, if the American people actually understand the gravity of what you're talking about, and I know you have been doing everything you possibly can do personally to elevate this issue and bring it to the public's awareness. Is there anything that they specifically can be demanding be done to remedy this right now? There is this waiver. There is an executive order that was promulgated by the previous administration. Is that really what needs to be done now, is simply to exercise that waiver, have the new administration embrace this precedent, and then build on that to address other and more comprehensively this problem of supply dependency on China?
Well, I think moving the Washington establishment without very strong leadership is going to take a very long time, and who knows whether it will result in anything, Frank. But one optimistic point is the private sector has to use its purchasing power and buy differently. And we've had a success with very large hospital systems like Mayo Clinic that said before the pandemic that we don't want these substandard drugs in our hospitals and we're going to buy differently. And they set up a nonprofit, and they have already supplied 60 basic medicines to their 1,400 hospitals, including Kaiser Permanente. And they're going to come out with their first retail drug, over-the-counter prescription drug, next year. So we are seeing smart, foresighted people using their money to create a new supply chain. And this entity is building a manufacturing plant as we speak in Virginia.
And these are you know, people who are willing to pay whatever the price is to do that, obviously. You know, they're not going to be discouraged from the fact that the Chinese can inevitably underbid them. This is very heartening, Rosemary. I hope you'll come back to us soon with further progress reports on this, and specifically whether there's any way that people can learn more and become more engaged. Maybe you could just say a word about how to reach you in that regard.
Thank you, Frank. On Twitter, it's at Rosemary100. I welcome direct messages on the subject. And we can fix this. It's absolutely a fixable problem.
Good. Well, that is the good news. And we look forward to working with you to that end. You're a wonderful, valued member of the Committee on the Present Danger of China. We hope that we'll have an opportunity to work with you more closely on all of this in that connection and otherwise. Rosemary Gibson, God bless you. It's good to have you with us. Come back soon. I hope the rest of you
Frank,
will do the same
pleasure.
Again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.